Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring my co-host Emma Burnell, who is a Labour blogger. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hello. Now, for the last couple of weeks, we've been at party conferences. So I was at the Lib Dem conference and did one recorded sort of live there, although obviously it was released afterwards. And then we did one last week at Labour conference down in Brighton, where we all sat around a table in a restaurant and recorded it. And we thought we really needed to do one for the Tory conference as well. But unfortunately, we haven't gone to Manchester. So we've done the next best thing, which is that we've got a couple of Conservative members who are very kindly agreed to join us tonight. And they are Graham Archer, who is a Conservative Party member and also a writer for the Daily Telegraph. Good evening, Graham.
Hello.
Hello. And we're also delighted to be joined by Amy Gray, who is an active party member and also an aspiring candidate for the Conservative Party. And she is actually in Manchester. Hello, Amy.
Hello. Greetings from the Premier Inn opposite Manchester Central. It's all very, very glamorous up here.
It's a classic of the party conference season, isn't it, to be in some Premier Inn or some Holiday Inn. I was in an Ibis Inn when I was in Glasgow a couple of weeks ago.
The point is, you have to stay in places like that now because they have conferences in the inner city rather than at the seaside.
Well, that's a very interesting point, actually. And seeing as you've raised it, Graham, maybe we'll cover that first and get that out of the way. So you actually wrote a piece for the Telegraph yesterday where you were essentially saying that you think it's a shame that party conferences seem to be increasingly moving away from being in seaside resorts. And you specifically referred to Brighton, which I think you said is your favourite place in the world. And actually, it's one of my favourite places in the world as well. So much so that that was one of my ulterior motives for going down to Labour conference last week, so I could go to Brighton for a couple of days. But do you think that it's actually detrimental to the whole conference experience, it not being in the seaside this time?
I do, and I know that sounds absurd. There's a couple of things going on in my head about it. There's this whole emotional attachment I have to the seaside. I grew up at the seaside, and I think anyone who comes from the seaside will know what I mean. At certain times in your life, you want to go back to the sea. I think it's good for everyone to spend time at the seaside. And the party hierarchy in deciding not to go to the seaside overlooked a few things. Number one, those of us who are party members and who attend, like Amy this week in Manchester, are usually taking annual leave in order to do so. It is a holiday as well as a political event. And great cities though Manchester and Birmingham are, I don't have quite as much fun there as I do when I go to the seaside. The other thing is the expense. I'm not claiming poverty or anything, I'm a very, very lucky person, but I noticed the massive difference in how much conference cost me when we stopped going to seaside resorts and started up the Birmingham-Manchester route. So Brighton is my favourite place on the planet, and nothing makes me happier than being there. But I also enjoyed it when we went to Blackpool and to Bournemouth and places like that. And the fact is they were much, much cheaper, as well as just more pleasant environments in which to pass a week, particularly if you get one like this one where we have some unseasonably good weather. I do remember, I can't remember the guy's name, so it's not like I'm trying to protect a source or anything, but somebody senior in the Voluntary Association, when I asked them about it once years ago, said, I said it's so much more expensive, doesn't it put activists off coming? He said something like, that's the whole effing point. Now, he was probably making a joke, so I don't want to read too much into that, but the fact is, since we've stopped going to seaside resorts where it was easy to get cheap and cheerful accommodation and have a bit of fun by the sea, and started going to plush inner city conference centres, the price has gone up. To stay in a nice hotel, it'll cost you something like £600 this week in Manchester, and that's before the conference accreditation. And then when you do go, you find yourself vastly outnumbered by lobbyists and other professional people with an axe to grind in all of the meetings that you go to. So those two things came together in my head this year, and I thought, I don't want to make a big thing out of this. I think the Telegraph headline says something like, why I'm boycotting conference. I don't mean I'm never going to go again, but I did think, you know what, this year I looked Labour down at Brighton and thought, lucky old Labour Party, I just don't feel like getting on a train and going up to Manchester for 4 days and sitting in a Premier Inn or something similar, such as where Amy finds herself this evening.
So Amy, what do you think? Are you happy to be in Manchester, or would you prefer to be by the sea?
I love being by the seaside. Wouldn't it be fun if we could start the day at conference with a sort of morning swim? And I'm sure David Cameron would join us all. He legendarily loves cold water swimming as much as your next sort of person who spent all their holidays in Scotland. I've never actually done a seaside conference. So this is my first party conference solely as a member. I used to work for the party, so I'd always be here in a work capacity. And my husband and I thought it would be quite a nice trip to do together, to take, like Graham said, take a couple of days holiday and come to the party conference and choose the fringe events that we're going to and go to things which interest us. I think I do agree with Graham that it would probably be nicer to be in a more sort of attractive setting. But logistically, to have a conference in the middle of the country, in a city which is a major rail hub, you know, with a conference centre which is set up to do events like this all the time, the travel is probably much easier for, you know, other party members coming down from parts of the north. If you're coming down from Scotland, you know, it's just much easier to get to Manchester than if you'd go down to Brighton. So I think we've sort of traded convenience and accessibility for charm and a little bit of atmosphere. When I used to work for the party, it was in a press briefing capacity, and I remember talking to one of Graham's colleagues at the Daily Telegraph who thought that it was a wonderful thing that we didn't go to Blackpool anymore because of the B&Bs that they all had to stay in. And they all, you know, the press lobby all had these stories about crazy landladies and peeling wallpaper and having to walk 3 miles to get to the conference centre.
But that's all part of the experience, though, isn't it? I mean, that's why you go to places.
So I'm enjoying myself in Manchester. It was nice to be up here. You know, it is a great city, but I think I'm probably inclined to Graham's view that it would be nice to be in a sort of slightly smaller place, staying in a slightly ramshackle B&B with some character, rather than in a Premier Inn where all 500 rooms look exactly the same.
Yeah, and if you get the chance as well, I don't know how whether you've been to Manchester very often, but get down to Rushholme and get yourself a curry. There's some fantastic places there. I used to study in Manchester, so I have some very, very fond memories of the place.
I think that's what I'm doing after we finish talking. I think that's where we're coming out.
Excellent. Great.
You guys were at the Labour meeting in Brighton last week. I read Matthew Paris's notebook during the week, and he said something like the security is much more relaxed than at previous conferences, and it absolutely transformed the experience of it. And I think wherever we meet, that's something that has obviously since 1984 and more recent events made it just a much less enjoyable thing. So I was interested to hear if that was true.
Absolutely. It was amazing. There were still people checking your pass in and out, but you weren't... Yeah, the bag scanning was random rather than everybody, and it wasn't through those sort of airport security type machines. It was just people at tables like you get with a gig or something. And there was no queues. You didn't have to factor in 15 to 20 minutes to get in and out of the conference centre, which meant that you could go in and out much more easily. You could go off to a fringe meeting without worrying about missing anything. You could go meet a friend. You could, you know, do lots of different things. And it made the conference experience much, much more relaxed, much more open. It just felt so much nicer.
There's something so off-putting about the barricades over and above the basic reason for having them.
Yeah.
I remember in Manchester a few years ago, I was in a pub in Canal Street, and this guy said, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And I was like, "Oh, God, I'm here for the third-party conference." And he said, "Oh, right, oh, no, that sounds really interesting. Is there anything that folk like me could come to?" And you're right, just cross them out. No, absolutely not. Wherever we meet now, no, you can't come. There's no way of opening it up to sort of interested passers-by. And that's such a shame, isn't it? So I was really excited to hear about the Labour. Maybe now we're getting that we can sort of wind it back a bit and stop being so barricaded away.
So I looking through the fringe listings as I have kind of planning out my next couple of days, there's quite a lot going on outside the conference secure zones. There's quite a lot going on in, you know, the town hall and other hotels. You're close enough to the conference centre. So I think those opportunities are there. What I don't know is if they're publicised at all in the Manchester Evening News, or if, you know, those flyers are going out in the student union. so that you know, so that people who live in Manchester can actually find out about it.
I very much doubt it. If it's anything like the other parties, I think that stuff is basically, you know, I mean, there's nothing to stop people if they want to seek it out. Like when I went down to Labour conference, following Emma's advice, I downloaded the Labour app. I didn't have to be a member to do it, just downloaded it, and everything was on there. And I just skulked around the fringe. I never bothered buying a pass because it was going to be a couple of hundred quid, I think, for a media accreditation, which is what I'd have had to have been. So I thought, nah, forget that. So I just went to some fringe meetings, and no one checked any idea. I was straight in there. I was sitting in front of Alan Milburn and Brian Gould and various other people. I could have got into the Diane Abbott one as well, actually.
Did you go to a fringe meeting in the 1980s?
Maybe we'll come to Ed Miliband later.
That was a coalition joke.
So Emma, just
the whole
just
coalition's a joke, isn't it?
Yeah. Emma, just briefly, what do you think about this idea of, you know, the party conferences being in, you know, perhaps less traditional areas now? Do you think it's okay? So you've been spoiled by Brighton anyway, haven't you?
My favourite is Manchester, actually. I mean, I love the city. I'm a city girl. You know, for me, I love cities and going to Manchester and seeing the similarities and the differences with London is such a sort of interesting thing. I think also there is, I mean, it is perfectly possible to get cheap B&B accommodation in Manchester because I've done it every year. I very rarely go for one of the big hotels. There's quite a good pub that I usually stay above. I think the idea that you'll have a different conference experience, it doesn't match my conference experience, which is so totally centred around the conference that whatever the backdrop is not that important. You know, I'm not going for a stroll along the beach or heading off to the People's History Museum. I'm not, you know, unless I decided to stay a couple of extra days, I just haven't got a spare minute in the day. So I think it doesn't make that much difference to my conference experience where it is. I would say in terms of the reaching out stuff, we have actually been looking at this quite a lot. I mean, I agree with Mark that the fringe is now really, really open. 90% of the fringe at Labour Party conference happens outside the zone. Our zone seems to be shrinking every year, which is a good thing. But also I think last year, Ed Miliband did a Q&A with readers of the Manchester Evening News. And that was a deliberate sort of trying to open up conference to more people.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, one thing that is noticeable just walking around this evening is the number of police. And I think that's probably linked to the protest that there was earlier. I think that there were 50,000 people or something like that. I missed that. My train arrived after that had finished. But there are a lot of anti-Badger Coal protesters around. That seems to be this year's kind of big issue.
It was a big NHS demo was the main thing.
And some of them are still around as well. So there are a lot of police. And it feels, I don't know, once you're in the conference venue, it feels fine. But I think if I lived in Manchester, I might feel like my city had been taken over a little bit in a way that isn't entirely friendly.
Okay. Well, maybe if we move on from venue stuff. So one of the things we wanted to try and cover today, and maybe if we start with you, Amy, just kind of general feeling of the conference. I mean, obviously you're there, so maybe a bit of a taking of the temperature of how, you know, other activists feel and so forth, and just maybe what you think is going to come up over the next few days, the kind of the highlights to look forward to.
It feels it's pretty upbeat here. I think it's very, very focused on 2015. So looking at the fringe events, kind of listening to what people are talking about, people are really, really focused on the general election in, you know, a year and a half time and what we have to do to win that election. So there's quite a lot of internal soul searching. I think there's a lot of looking at the party and going, you know, where are our heartlands? What do we need to do to keep those? But how are we going to win over the floating voters? So I was at a Women to Win reception this evening. Maria Miller came along, Lord Feldman came along, lots of female MPs there, lots of talk about candidate selections happening at the moment, and lots of discussion about the numbers of women who are being selected. It felt very, really positive, actually. It was quite exciting to go to a reception where everyone was feeling quite upbeat. So I think what people will be looking for from the platforms at the fringes is answers, really. I'm not sure how many of those we will get, But what we'll be looking for in the next 3 days, and for David Cameron to give us on Wednesday, is a very clear route to here is what we're going to be doing for Conservatives in government in the next, you know, less than 2 years. This is how that is going to get us a proper working majority in 2015. So that, for me, is what I'm looking for here, and I think that's what's really going to be dominating.
Do you think that that's a realistic prospect? Because, I mean, I'm increasingly reading that off the record, you know, senior Conservative ministers are basically admitting that they don't think there's very much chance at all of getting majority. And it's more about, you know, how to stem the losses and perhaps, you know, kind of tread water, stay roughly where they are, and maybe another coalition. I mean, are you picking any of that up?
There is no sense of that here. And probably that's because the members absolutely, you know, will be working for a majority and will be knocking on all those doors, delivering all those leaflets. But I don't. There are some discussions, I think, happening about, you know, can England ever love coalitions? But there, to me, there's a very, very strong sense that we have to get a majority in 2015. That is the real focus here.
It's obviously harder now, Mark, thanks to the Liberals' decision not to support boundary reform. and I think we've been for a long time, because I should say, Amy, I agree with you. I have this feeling that something's changed. I was trying to put my finger on what it is. It's obviously not the opinion polls very much, despite, you know, 15 stories a day about every fractional change in the Labour lead. Another boring story is written about it. It's I wonder if it's a conflation of the heartening news about the economy, mild though it as yet is, and this sounds weird, but I'm thinking laterally, which is a fancy way of saying it. I'm going to say something completely stupid. I have a feeling, in my own tummy, I feel like Angela Merkel's re-election has changed things somehow. Because it might, I think we thought, well, you know, we did pretty good, given the mountain we had to climb in 2010, to get as far as we got. And then surely a sitting administration is rarely re-elected in Britain with a higher share of the vote. So how do we get that 8-point differential, whatever the electoral calculus website says is required to win a Tory majority of one? How could that possibly happen? It can't possibly happen. And then Mrs. Merkel just did it, didn't she? And you think, well, all that guff about sophology is interesting when you look at the past. It's not necessarily a good predictor of future voting behaviour, and if people think the administration's doing well, then more of them will vote for it than last time if they can win over the doubters. I think there's some sort of psychological change. It's not a change to do with an act of legislation or even anything particularly in the opinion polls, but it does feel a slightly more optimistic time to be a Conservative than it did perhaps this time last year.
I mean, I think there are probably a number of factors that mean we're in uncharted territory, and I think, like you say, the past isn't necessarily a guide to the future, and I think that has never been more true than at the moment. I mean, obviously, you've got the fact that we have the coalition, so the Lib Dems are in government for the first time in however many decades it is, and their polling numbers, okay, our polling numbers have fallen through the floor. I'll stop talking in the third person stroke party.
It's hard, isn't it? I never know how to do that. I never, should I say they or should I say we? I never know that.
I know, because I've kind of got two hats. I'm sort of a commentator, but I'm also a Lib Dem. So you've got that fact. You've also got the UKIP factor. And you've got the fact that, you know, we've had the worst financial crisis for several generations, and you put all of that into the pot, and really, realistically, no one knows what's going to happen, and anyone who says they do is lying. It's just that I think with, you know, the kind of the new political situation, the fact that we've had the coalition, the fact that, you know, as you rightly point out, the boundary changes didn't go through. And as a little aside, there's an interesting moment, I thought, in Nick Clegg's speech a couple of weeks ago, when he made the direct link between that and House of Lords reform, which I don't think he'd done before. He actually,
I thought that was your putative reason for reneging on that.
Yeah, he'd always said it was part of a package of measures, and the fact that the whole package. But he
did. Look, don't make me quote. Do you know what? I can actually quote that bit of the coalition agreement? No, I can't quote it. I can. It's on page 23. On page 23, it says the coalition will support the bringing forward of ideas for Lords reform, and then it goes on to explicitly say that constituency sizes will be equalised. So the latter was a firm commitment, and the former was an opening for proposals, and perhaps
I mean, we could spend several minutes arguing about that, but the point is, Clegg did make the link, and you're right, the fact that the boundary changes aren't there, I think, does make quite a significant difference as well. Emma, do you have any thoughts on this?
We had a really great conference in many, many ways, and it just felt like, I think we had, when we met on the Sunday, wasn't it, before Ed's speech, I think we were all kind of saying, here's what needs to be done, here's the conversation that needs to be had, here's what Ed needs to offer. And I think he did all of the things that we were talking about kind of in spades. It was a good speech in terms of presentation and delivery, and B, it was full of very popular measures that are quite different from things that would have been offered potentially under New Labour.
And as we sat there on Sunday, did you think that there was any chance that he'd be reintroducing 1970s price controls?
It's different to New Labour. It wasn't that different to Labour, was it?
If you want to talk about the people who behaved like they had a right to run the country over the heads of democratically elected politicians, which is frequently what is said about the unions from the 1970s, I think the way the energy companies reacted absolutely showed that they are behaving just as badly, just as bullishly, just as self-entitledly, and just as anti-democratically as anything that could be said about a 1970s trade union.
And Emma, if the government establishes that its rights interfere with the right of contract and property as well, don't forget his other big announcement, what else might the government suddenly announce it was going to take control of?
Well, the government takes control of those things every day in different ways. I mean, I'm currently selling and buying a house, and I have to do all sorts of things legally in order to do that. It's not that the government doesn't have a part in that, a role in that.
Yeah, you're regulated within the market, so you can't lie to people and so forth. But you're not, the government doesn't step in and say, Emma, you can't charge more than £X thousand for your house.
Certain things,
or indeed say, you've not been doing what we want you to do with that piece of land, so it now belongs to us, which was his other great announcement, wasn't it?
An announcement that he stole from Boris Johnson, of course.
I don't. Okay. The provenance of the idea is irrelevant to me. It's the toxicity of the underlying idea.
It's a great idea because it's the only way that you'll end land banking. And as someone for whom housing is a huge, huge issue, I think that's one of the things we absolutely need to end. If your line, and I think this is really, really interesting, the whole Red Ed line from the Conservatives, from the Conservative supporting press, from right up to that disgusting piece, which I think we could all probably say was an appalling piece in the Daily Mail about Ed Miliband's father, the man who hated Britain so much he fought in the war for us, absolutely terrible journalism. But the whole line that this is unpopular socialism actually is completely negated by how popular these measures are. And it's an interesting shift from the Labour Party to say, well, actually, let's try and sell some popular socialism and move away from the New Labour trick of trying to be just a little bit less capitalist than everybody else. And
it's not anti-capitalism.
When you're talking about the price freeze is only for 20 months, while measures are brought in to try and break up the domination of the market by a few players, which is not a free market.
So it's exactly the right. Harold Wilson attempted in 1974, isn't it, with a different name. Of course, it's popular to say to people, we'll make electricity freer and we'll do something about nasty Tescos. I am no fan of Tescos, but it's always Tescos that gets picked on when it comes up, when we talk about land banking, as though it would have anything serious to do about the problem of lack of housing in this country. There's one solution to the lack of housing in this country, and it's to build more bloody houses. It's not to fuss around ownership of it. But that's how it starts. It starts with the popular. Of course, we're on the side of the poor and the oppressed and the miserable, and then we'll bring in this law that will make their life better, and then it won't work, and then we'll have to do something else. That's how we ended up with inflation through the roof in the 70s. And people, I'm old and you're all younger than me, but it's illegal where I work to refer to somebody's age. That's why I'm fumbling over my words. So I'm old enough to remember what happened when you start off down that road. And I think all the voter, the reason the Conservatives are exploding with glee isn't because they think it's going to be fun saying that the energy companies are on the side of sweet and light. It's because they know there's a cohort of the voting demographic, that cohort which is most likely to vote, that remembers exactly what happened to the country when it was governed by pre-New Labour Labour.
Amy, what do you think about this?
Well, I think what really struck me about Miliband's speech was what he left out. So, you know, yes, I disagree with price controls, and I think government kind of seizing private property is really, really not the answer. But there was nothing about education. There was nothing about immigration. There was nothing about welfare. And these are the issues which people are always asking us about. What are you going to do about, you know, we think levels of immigration are too high, we really like your benefit reforms, but will you go further? That's what the polling tells us people want from the Conservatives. And I think he didn't even try to address any of those. Well, how are we going to improve schools? How are we going to, you know, narrow gaps in social inequality? And none of the Labour front benches seems to be allowed to come out with answers to those questions. So, you know, there was no big proposal about welfare. There was no big proposal about crime. And I don't know if he's scared of letting his front benchers come up with their own ideas, or if, you know, if there's a reshuffle coming and he just
they'll all start briefing against each other again
to get rid of everyone. But I mean, it was in places a very well delivered speech. But to me, it just wasn't a very complete vision of what Ed Miliband's Britain would be like.
And also,
to me, it was hopelessly flawed.
Surely the worst sting line in a speech ever, you know, an image of Ed Miliband in my head saying over and over again, Britain can do better than this. Well, you know, as a tribal Tory, yes. I would completely agree with that, Mr. Miliband. We can do a lot better than you.
I have to say...
Yes, what flashed into my head was, there's our election poster!
If you have an election poster with Ed Miliband's face, we will almost pay you to do it. It worked so well when you did it with Gordon Brown.
There's already an internet meme going around that's got, in that kind of font you see on these memes, that actually says, Britain can do better than this, with Ed Miliband's face in it. So it has already started. I have to say, from my perspective, I was actually, again... and I keep finding myself in this position, very impressed with him. I think he's trying to do what George Osborne and others think isn't really possible, which is trying to move the centre ground from opposition. Mm-hmm. And I think he's having a pretty good stab at it. And I think if the Tories are gleeful about his energy price announcement, I think they're a bit mistaken, because I think it will be very popular. And however unworkable it may be, and I have a lot of suspicions that it is unworkable, I'm not sure your average Joe really cares about that. Energy prices are one of the things that
yes.
piss people off the
not,
most.
Not disagreeing with an atom of that. And don't mistake my gleefulness at his 1970s Redux persona as a defence of corporatism. And that is a strand that's been missing, I think, too much from this administration. Perhaps Mr. Miliband will wake the Treasury up to see if there's anything they can do about it. To be in favour of market-led economies is not to be a defender of any corporation because it happens to be massive. In fact, proper conservatism should be the opposite. Proper liberalism should certainly be the opposite, Mark. So what sort of liberal are you?
What sort of liberal am I? No, like I said, I don't agree with what he said, but I think that, again, I'm putting my commentator hat on. I think that he is actually having a very good stab at moving the centre ground from opposition. And I think it has a chance of working here. I think Jonathan Friedland in The Guardian described it as left populism, or the populist left, or something like that. I think the idea is that the right usually has the best tunes to play. And actually what he's trying to do is subvert that and have some good tunes to play from the left.
I have nothing but admiration for Jonathan Friedland, who's a brilliant writer, but I disagree with that diagnosis. The left has the best tunes always because it carves out the moral high ground for itself and casts its opponents as greedy and selfish. Every political campaign in my existence has pivoted around, do you want to be nice to people or do you want to put yourself first? In, you know, that's the narrative that the left crafts, and I think they're extremely successful in having it as the accepted opinion.
Okay, maybe we just need to draw a line under this, because I'm very conscious that we've kind of gone off into talk about Ed Miliband in a what's supposed to be kind of conservative conference special. So maybe if we just draw it back to some of the announcements that we've seen in the last day or two. I'd just like to get everyone's thoughts on the married couples tax allowance announcement. So just very briefly, for anyone who's not aware, what David Cameron has announced is that there will be £1,000 worth of tax allowance that can be transferred from one spouse to another, and this would also apply to civil partnerships and I think basically all types of marriage, since the marriage bill was brought in. But there are quite a lot of married couples for whom it wouldn't apply, so if you pay a high rate tax, and there are various other exemptions and so forth. Amy, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this is a good policy, or do you think it's just Cameron trying to kind of appeal to his base core?
I think it's possible for a policy both to appeal to the core Conservative vote and be a good policy.
And do you think this is both of those things?
I'm pleased to see some recognition of marriage in the tax system. It's something Conservatives have long said they want. And, you know, marriage works. The evidence you know, the children who grow up in married families do much better at school, for example. It's the essential building block of our society is the family. And I think married couples stay together longer, are healthier and happier. I'm not just saying this because I got married last year, but there's a lot of evidence that says that marriage is good for individuals, it's good for society. So I think for government to say that we absolutely recognise that you're doing a very good thing. I like that it's targeted at low rate taxpayers, lower income families. I think any help that we can offer them is absolutely fantastic. So I'm thrilled, really. Okay. You know, as a part of that core Conservative vote.
I'm going to be slightly careful here because I'm aware that Graham works in statistics, so he'll probably pick me up on this. But Amy, correlation is not causation. And just because there are certain things that seem to be correlated with people being married doesn't necessarily mean it's marriage that causes that.
Can I have a go there?
Yeah, go on then, Graham.
Yeah, let's let the professional come
okay,
in there.
Okay, go on.
Well, I'm not going to prove either way, but to me, the answer is that this boils down to the untestable axioms of your fundamental belief system. And it's interesting, this is one area where I would expect to respectfully disagree with a liberal. There's such an overlap between liberal Tories and classic liberals. This is one area where I think we wouldn't agree, I think, because the fundamental unit of merit for a liberal is the individual. And I think, although not often stated, particularly not in the last few decades, the fundamental unit of political merit for a Conservative is the family. And then certain things follow from that. Amy, you said that marriage works. I agree with you and think it should be as, I think it is as potent a slogan as prison works was in the 90s. Although there's an unfortunate attention, you're absolutely correct in your summing up of the statistics. Mark, are also correct. You're quite right. I mean, I have a PhD in statistics. I can't sit here and say that correlation is indicative of causation, but neither does it rule it out. So either there has to be some latent theory to explain it, and either it is that indeed by society conferring a certain status on marriage that inculcates the psychological well-being required for all the other good things that flow from it and which manifest itself through that myriad of statistics which we can see reporting better outcomes for married people and their offspring, or there has to be some other theory of sociology which explains why it just happens that observed statistic after observed statistic points to the benefits of marriage. I've never heard what alternative competing theory there could be.
Well, I
do
hear.
What is it?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's not a fully worked up, you know, theory that I've ever submitted for peer review, but it would just be that the good things, the good outcomes are correlated with something else. And maybe it's...
Yes.
Maybe it's
yeah,
wealth,
well, is that
maybe
something
it's,
else?
Yeah. So maybe
what
it's,
is it?
Yeah, but maybe it's wealth. Maybe it's, you know, the areas of the country that you live in. Maybe it's, you know, family background. And those types of people tend to be the ones who get married because of tradition or because of whatever. And therefore, it seems like marriage is good for these things, when actually the marriage is a side issue. It's actually the other things, and trying to...
No, but it's these other things that are always made. That's what people say.
But the point is, Graham, though, that trying to put something in the tax system to reward marriage is a bit strange if it's not marriage that's really the thing that's causing those things, if it's other things that just happen to be correlated with marriage.
Well, as I said, it boils down to axiomatic belief, and it's not testable. There is no sociological experiment that would pass ethical muster that you could design in order to test either my hypothesis or yours. And so you have to rely on what your stomach's telling you, and that usually translates to what does history tell us. And history says to me that the most successful societies are the ones that have strong families that are able to look after one another and be as independent of the state as possible.
Okay, Emma, what do you reckon? What's your gut telling you?
My gut is feeling really, really sick. My husband turned out to be an adulterous bastard and fucked off with a slag. Hey, government, give me a tax hike. Nice. It's yet again the Tory
paper. That's like the argument used against gay marriage. That is exactly like the sort of nonsense argument used against gay marriage. Because not all marriages are great, the argument I heard during the debate about gay marriage, when people would say, look at that pop singer, I don't know her name, she got married for 12 hours or something. So what's so special about marriage?
Saying, why am I being punished with a tax hike? Because my husband...
You're not being punished with a tax hike. You're not
being punished with a tax hike. I would go from being married and qualifying for...
No, that's the inversion of language which you use with the so-called bedroom tax. Not qualifying for a tax break is not the same as paying a tax hike.
My taxes would go up. It's exactly the same feeling.
But they wouldn't go up.
They would, because I would no longer have a tax break. He's hating single mothers.
Nonsense.
And it doesn't fit into their classic little family grouping.
No, it's nonsense. What it's about is institutionalising what's good for people, which is why I'm proud.
Institutionalising you don't belong.
No. So why would... If Tories' approach to marriage is about saying to people, you don't belong, why take the political risk and the capital hit by institutionalising gay marriage? That proves my point. That's about conservatives. Conservatives saying that this institution matters so much, we want to extend its parameters to include as many people as possible.
Except and speaking of someone...
You can quote from unattributed briefings as much as you like. I'm a 43-year-old gay man, and it's taking a conservative liberal coalition to allow me to get married. Why do you think so many of us want to be able to do it, by the way, if it's just some other thing that leads to the good outcomes of people? It's because as outsiders, permanently excluded outsiders throughout history until now, we've watched the benefits that flow within our own families and all the other ones that we've not been allowed to join. That's why marriage is important for me, and that's why it's right for the government to signal through the tax law that it's a better way for people to live.
The value of marriage by opening it up to all people who love each other. I was 100% behind that, and I said very loudly that I thought it was a good thing for this government to do, and I was pleased that this government did it. What it is not a good thing to do is say everyone who's outside of this institution, for whatever reason, whether it's because their philandering husband's fucked off, whether it's because they never had, whether it's because their philandering husband has died or their non-philandering husband has died, whether it's because they never got married in the first place, they are not good enough. Their families are not good enough.
An absolute refusal to judge behaviour is what got the country into the mess it was by 2010. And using harmless examples.
Because people don't get married, their partners crashed our economy.
Who died, it's not what we're really talking about here, is it? We're talking about the general urge to encourage people to pair bond for life.
Pair bond for life, unless you happen to be in any one of those circumstances I've just outlined. And by the way, what on earth are you talking about? The bankers crashed our economy because people weren't getting married.
I did say in the social... I mean, if you want to shout, that's fine. Go ahead.
No, come on. But the mess our country is in by 2010. Really? What mess is our country in? Crime was going down. So if you're talking about social policy, crime went down considerably over the last 15 years. Yeah, the mess our country is in is economic.
I lived in inner London up until after the end of the last election, and the phenomenon of the rise of the estate of fatherless boys isn't something that was invented by tabloid journalists, and I'm not doing it from a oh, they frighten me, oh, they're awful. I'm talking about the pity of it. I had a friend who ran a community club in Hackney, and used to take them out, you know, take them to the seaside to link back in with our first round. And practically none of the children he worked with had access to their biological father. That system didn't happen by random accident.
And those mothers are exactly the ones who are stigmatizing.
Incremental changes, all of which were designed to increase the level of good, and unfortunately, all of which ended up with that situation. That's the situation to which I was referring, nothing to do with the banker's crisis.
I mean, I recognise the picture that Graham is painting. I used to be a teacher at a girls' comprehensive school in Hackney as well, and the number of girls that didn't know their fathers, the number of girls whose parents weren't living together. I think it's about saying to people that we value the commitment that you make to each other, that we know it's really important for children particularly. And yes, sometimes relationships break down, but we want to incentivize you to stay together. Fixing the benefit system so that you're not penalized if you live with your partner, for example. It's about using the levers the government has at its disposal to create the best possible environment for children to grow up in, particularly. And having, you know, I see it in the church I go to in East London, I saw it in the school I taught in, having a generation of children who haven't ever known one of their parents, who haven't ever known their parents living together, is astonishingly damaging for those young people.
And
of course, we're not saying, before you say it, of course, we're not saying the marriage tax alliance will fix all of that. But as Amy says, this is one of a raft of measures which this administration is undertaking to reset marriage at the centre of our culture.
To stigmatise exactly those people who are suffering in the areas that you're talking about.
Okay, all right. I think there's a danger we'll start going around in circles, says. I think it's pretty clear where everyone stands on this. I mean, from my perspective, I struggle to see how this is a fair and just thing. There are so many people who are excluded from this for all kinds of different reasons. And I mean, Emma's highlighted a couple of them, but, you know, and, the big one, or, you know, one of the big ones for me is, you know, people who just end up single through no fault of their own, either because, you know, the partner's left or maybe they're abused.
And there are too many of these people. There are too many. This is the great unstated political problem of our time. The age of loneliness and atomization. And of course, I'm not saying that fiddling around with the tax system will fix that. I'm not even disagreeing with anything that any of you have said. But isn't it interesting that four bright and committed political activists get together and we spend an hour talking about a small change in the tax system? Nobody ever on these programmes talks about why are so many people so lonely? Why is there so much depression these days? Is it higher than it used to be? It certainly feels like it.
Well, and, you know, I'm not going to fire back that, you know, exactly like you said, this particular tax measure is going to change any of that, because I don't think that's what it's designed to do. And as you point out, it's part of a raft of measures. But I mean, I just wonder how popular this is going to be, given that it excludes so many people. I think it might appeal to the Tory base, but I struggle to see how this is going to appeal to many, many people throughout the country who, however you want to present it, it is going to seem like a tax, you know, like a tax giveaway to a certain group of people who happen to fit in to a certain pattern. And it sounds like from what you're saying, Graham, that you're fine with that. Actually, more than fine with that. You think that is absolutely the right thing to do and that it needs to send a message to people.
Well, I don't know if I'd use the words exchanged in the heat of the moment for a more calibrated version of it. You seeing it in a negative sense, I see it in a positive sense. I think there's a difference between magnetizing something good to make it more attractive to more people and to help more people in that state retain that state. You see it as locking out people who, for one reason or another, aren't within that state, as though, you know, all of the benefit system only goes to people who are married, all of the advantages in life only go to people who are married that are under the government's control. Of course, that isn't the case. On the one hand, you say it's a tiny financial measure. On the other hand, you claim that it stigmatises, I don't know, 50% of the population.
But something doesn't have to be big in order to stigmatise people.
And that's Amy's and my point, but in a positive sense. Something doesn't have to be big to signal something that there's something good about a particular state and that we'd like to encourage more people to be in that state.
It's also looking a little bit more widely at the idea of aspiration. So I think lots of people, when they talk about aspiration, you talk about perhaps material things or financial aspirations, and that's one way in which you can you can secure a better life for yourselves and for your family. But I don't think we just aspire to having a bigger car or having nicer holidays. I think most people aspire to finding a life partner. You know, that's absolutely something that everyone should feel that they are supported in doing. And I think that's something that this policy does. It says, you know, we're a party of aspiration, not just financial, not just economic, but about bettering your life in every way that you can. If you find that person and you make that home together, we will absolutely support you. I think it's a really joyous message, actually. I think it's a really positive thing to go out there and talk to people about.
Okay. We're clearly not going to agree on this. There was also an announcement by Cameron, I think, today, that he wants to bring forward an extension to the right to buy. Now, one of the things that worries me about this is that I already think that the initial right to buy is risking pumping up another housing bubble. And it seems increasingly to me like Cameron and Osborne don't really care too much about that. And they're just happy to see that happen because it will help the economy, because our economy is so closely linked with house prices. Graham, what do you think about this?
I don't know anything about policy about buying. I'm just looking it up on the web. We need a review of right to buy syrup.
I think it's help to buy because they're quite different policies.
Sorry, you mean to help
people get more.
That's right. I misspoke. It's help to buy, not right.
Sorry, thank you.
All right, yeah, go on.
Gosh, well, actually, earlier when I was ranting away about something completely different, I said something about we need to build more bloody houses, and I'd just like to offer that again. I obviously support anything which, within fiscal reason, enables more people to get on the housing ladder. Have you seen that utterly compelling advert from the bank? I was watching it just before I came up the stairs. Some boy going, I'm 31 and still living with mum and dad, and so on.
Yes.
Very, very clever and everything. It's basically saying get in debt to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds to us for the rest of your life. So I'm not speaking in favour of the banks, Emma, before you shout at me. But I thought it was very effective because it is astonishing to somebody like me. I'm in my mid-40s, how awful it is for the generation that's come after me in getting access to housing. I mean, I never had it. My first house was this little place in Harlow, and you know, it wouldn't have been any architectural prizes. But the fact that it was there and I was able to buy it was because a farmer sold his field to a developer who built houses on it. Maybe quite atypical, and Emma, I think one of the best things your movement ever did, and I don't understand why I don't go on about it more, was the New Town movement and the Garden City movement. I'm a huge fan of New Towns, and sorry, I'm waffling. The fact is, I would never have got on the housing ladder if we hadn't had some sort of planning law that allowed the farmer to sell a field for profit, which was concreted over and turned into New Town housing that enabled me at the age of 28 to buy my first house. That opportunity just seems to have gone.
Yeah.
I support what the government wants to do as long as, you know, it can be afforded, and I don't get the impression with this administration that it would waste money that it doesn't have. But the biggest issue for me is that we're not building enough houses and everything else is more or less tinkering.
Amy, what do you think?
Well, I'm 30. I went to 8 weddings this year. So, you know, lots of my, I'm right at the age of people who are sort of settling down, looking to get on that property ladder. And it's so hard. It's so hard out there. And maybe it's because, you know, most of my friends are in sort of London in the southeast, but, you know, friends who are museum assistants, friends who are teachers, friends who are junior doctors. It's just impossible unless you've got family money, and that can't be right. It can't be right that the only way you can scrape a deposit together is if your parents are rich enough to bung you several tens of thousands of pounds. So I'm pleased that there's a way to help people. I do want to see more house building, even to change use of derelict buildings, more redevelopment of brownfield sites. I think that will happen, but I'd like to see that being accelerated alongside Help to Buy. So I welcome it, but I want to see a bit more.
Are you not worried, though, that a kind of Help to Buy scheme like the previous one and like this latest one are just going to mean that in a few years' time, houses are even more out of reach for perhaps the next tranche of people who come along in, say, 5 years' time, when there is no longer a Help to Buy scheme in place, because it's only seen as a kind of palliative measure to help get through the, you know, the financial crisis at the moment.
To get them lending again, yeah.
Yeah, that you end up with people who, it's going to be another £50,000 or £100,000 further out of their reach in a few years' time.
Of course it's a risk, and of course you have to rely on the Bank of England to keep its eye on inflationary pressures right across the board, not least with regard to the housing market. But, you know, I'm no economist, but I'm pretty certain that the price is determined by the amount of commodity available, yeah, rather than any scheme the government can do.
Well, you certainly won't get any argument from me about that. Emma, what do you think? You've got a bit of a specialism in the housing area, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I used to work in housing, and I'm a member of Labour Housing Group, so I do a lot of campaigning on housing. And the thing about Help to Buy is what it's doing is pumping up the house price market, but it's not putting money in bricks. And that's where the money really, really ought to be going. That's where the focus should be, is building new housing. I completely agree with Graham on pretty much everything he said.
Hurrah!
We should be building a lot more housing. The Newtown development is something Labour should be much prouder of, much more focused on shouting out about in our past, but also bringing forward into our future and saying, you know, this is something that we believe is essential to the future of Britain, and to actually really, you know, we tried to do it with eco towns and we failed, and we need to be better at that. And we need to just get things happening. We need to have housing built across every tenure. Part of the big problem in the drop-off of housing was that the housing grant for social housing was cut by 63%. It was the largest government cut in any area. And that just led to an absolute... Yeah, and at that time, social housing was the only housing that was really being built, because the housing, private sector housing market just wasn't going anywhere. Now, it's still not going anywhere very fast, but it's getting a little better. But the social housing sector is still very far behind where it was, because there just isn't the money to build. So I think Help to Buy is a scheme which, to be quite honest, I personally, because I am moving right now, am massively benefiting individually from an incredibly, insanely overinflated market in London. And, you know, there is no way my house is worth what's being paid for it. But that's what the market forces are telling me. At the end of the day, that's not good, really. My downstairs neighbour who rents, I went to talk to her and she was like, yeah, we were talking about my sale. She said, oh, my God, I'm just completely fucked, aren't I? And there was nothing I could think to say to her other than, yeah, I'm really sorry. I think you are.
You can always move... I couldn't live in London. It took me about 4 leaps before I could get there. And some of the people in media land that I meet, I'm not talking about your neighbour, have unrealistic expectations. To think of. So I lived in Harlow and I still work in...
My neighbour's a nurse, so right, she's okay, not really media land.
All right, okay, fair enough. And I'm sure she's a wonderful person. And can't live further out. Well, of course, that's what happens. So I was going to say, some of the young people I know, I do wonder, why do you want to live, you know, anything beyond zone 3? And they start making jokes about oxygen masks, whereas I think it's quite nice to live out in the new towns that surround London and just put up with the travel. But of course, who really suffers are the people like nurses and teachers who can't afford inside London houses at all, and yet who have to commute in and out every day for work. Those are the people that I always... Not just the public sector ones either. We always, teachers and nurses, it trips off the tongue too easily, but the people who come in and clean the schools and make the meals in the hospitals and stuff, none of this, of course, will help them at all. Neither did the public key worker scheme previously. We need to build more houses.
Well, I think there's pretty much a note of consensus across everyone there. I mean, I think I've been saying this for years, and, you know, government minister after government minister from all different parties keep saying it, and it keeps not bloody happening. So I just, you know, I hope some of these pledges we've heard recently about more houses come to fruition, because I think even the pledges I've seen are talking about 200,000 a year. That's just what we need to keep standing still, really. I mean, Emma, maybe you'll correct me there, but I think we need even more than that.
We need more than that if we're going to solve the housing crisis. Yeah. 200,000 a year is what I call a good start.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, we probably need to wrap up soon, but Emma, you said you wanted something about a right of reply for Ed Miliband. Do you think we've kind of covered that, or was there something more specific?
I think I covered it earlier when we talked about the Daily Mail piece. It's just interesting that Ed Miliband has tweeted today, quite unusually from his Twitter account, a quite passionate tweet about how upset he is with the Daily Mail piece about his father, calling his father the man who hated Britain. And he's actually requested and has been given right of reply in the Daily Mail, which is, I think, quite an unusual move. In terms of, you know, usually you're expected to just suck it up as a political leader, you know, whatever they say about you. And I think it's quite an interesting move from Ed Miliband to say, no, there is so far and no further that you can go. And I think that's quite right, to be frank. I would not want to see the father of Nick Clegg or the father of David Cameron attacked in the same way.
Yeah, it wasn't very wholesome.
Well, in the run-up to the 2010 election, I mean, Clegg's family and his background and the fact that his wife, you know...
It's a constant theme of the UKIP brigade, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
He's married to someone who's not British.
I mean, I don't think it was quite as bad as what Ed Miliband's just had to endure, but, you know, it was of a similar nature.
Yeah, well, it shouldn't be allowed, and I think Clegg would have had just the right to say, no, don't, you know, so far and no further.
Yeah.
And I think if we can... if this becomes a line in the sand when Ed, if he leads a movement for politicians to say, you know, so far and no further, then I think that can only be a good thing for our politics.
Okay. Just before we wrap up, just for Graham and Amy, just thinking about Cameron's speech and the next two or three days of conference, is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to, either of you?
Amy, you go, since you're actually at conferences.
I'm a bit of a political nerd, so I'm excited about a couple of events I've got coming up, kind of how the Conservative Wing is changing Britain, talking about how we can incentivise best performance in schools. I'm looking for a sort of what would a Conservative government look like post-2015 from David Cameron on Wednesday. I'm going to be in the hall listening out for something along those lines. Sort of, I want a coherent narrative that I can go out and sell on the doorstep in Hackney or in Worcestershire, wherever I happen to be campaigning all over the country.
And do you think that Cameron's speech is the most important speech he's ever had to give?
I'd say, you know, every speech is more important than the last one. Is it the most important so far? It's not as important as next year's conference speech will be, but it's more important than last year's conference speech was.
I hope we get some sunshine back, if I'm honest. I'm coming to the opinion that the election is going to be a sort of Britain's on the right track, don't let socialism spoil it type campaign, or he'd like to frame it that way. And I'd like to, I hope he has a bit of fun with Mr. Miliband's speech, and as Amy does, absolutely now is the time to politely but firmly demarcate those areas in, within which we've not been able to legislate because of the fact of coalition. But I hope he does it in a gentlemanly way, and not just because of the whatever the post-election readout entails for forming another administration, but because although I've zigzagged all over the place and some days have felt like screaming about the Lib Dems, I'm actually now reverting to how I felt early on and thinking, actually, do you know, it hasn't been that bad. Simon Hughes is doing something about university access. But is that really worth losing sleep over when we're delivering so much good stuff across the board? Hope the Lib Dems feel the sort of same, vice versa. So I hope, yes, I want to know what it'd be like to have a Tory majority, and I want that Tory majority. I'd like some sunshine, though, in the speech. He finished one speech with Let the Sunshine Win, and the commentary has slagged them off for it, but it's the closest I've come to tears at a political speech in a long time. I just like the decent optimism.
I'm just making some notes here, Graham, because I think we could have found the 2015 Lib Dem election slogan. Lib Dems, we've not been that bad. I'll pass that on. Okay. All right. Well, I think we've just about run out of time there. But I think that's been a good one. It's been a bit heated, but there's been some consensus as well. So I just like
that's Lib Dem heaven, isn't it?
Indeed. Oh yeah. It's always got to be a bit of Barney, but then some consensus. That's how it works, isn't it? Okay. Yeah. Well, I just like to thank our guests. So thanks as usual to Emma.
Thank you.
And thanks to Graham Archer.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to Amy Gray. And also, Amy, I hope you enjoy the rest of conference up there in Manchester, and I hope you enjoy your curry later on.
Thank you very much. I plan to enjoy both of those things.
Good stuff. Okay. And I'd just like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompitech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back with after this 3-week hiatus of conference specials with a normal episode next week. Just one last thing before we finish. Nick Dennys, who is a conservative activist who's involved with Platform 10 and has been a guest on this podcast a few times before, is doing a daily podcast every morning from Conservative Conference where he's interviewed various people. They're only very short ones, 6 or 7 minutes, with a few interviews in each one, just taking the temperature of conference and getting people's views about the issues and how things are going. So if you want to check out on Audio Boo, it's called Nick's Fringe, and is also available through iTunes and I think other providers too.